session number 18493, reel 18.
Mr. Lupton, reel 18. You were wounded early in March, and with all your travels, this must be putting you April, mid to end of April 1942.
Yes. Well, by then we were, let's say, we'd recovered, and I suppose we were putting on weight and all the rest of it, and no stress, nothing. So I think it was doing us a lot of good. And when we were there, as I say, with very little to do, maybe go to the odd housey-housey outing, or which is now bingo, something like that in the camp area. Drink some of the Indian beer, which possible. It was quite a comfortable life, let's say. It was when we got moved on to Calcutta to the race course. I think they'd put us in the race course because they weren't using it for horse racing, except possibly at some time in the cooler moments when we weren't there. And even then, if they did want to use it, they'd have to clear all these troops out of the grandstands and shift them somewhere, I don't know where. But we were living on the grandstands, sleeping on the grandstands, on the benches, because there just wasn't anywhere else to, any camp or anything to put us in. And it was extremely boring there, because the only things you did were eat, sleep, walk about, and if you could get a pass out, go down to Calcutta City.
What was there to do in the city?
The usual. Eat, drink. For those who wanted, also find the women around the place, and that was it. Dance, perhaps, if you got to some part. I was lucky. My father, having been out in India for a long time, pre-war, many years, had lots of friends scattered about in India, and one of his friends was in Calcutta and invited me down to the, I forget what the biggest, poshest hotel was in the town, but we went there and had tea and a few drinks. Everybody else were officers, but I was a special one because I was with this civilian who was very high rank. And that was the only afternoon I really enjoyed, sort of breaking away entirely from the military routine, which certainly wasn't a hectic routine anyway in that camp, but just getting free of it and chatting with somebody, you might say normal, somewhat different anyway.
What was your impression of Calcutta as a, you know, as a whole?
Well, at that time it was pretty terrible. I believe it still is, in fact, in this respect, littered with migrants, people. They slept in the gutters, they died in the gutters, you know, and they were all around the place begging. And Calcutta City was a fine city, and big open spaces and so on, very grand, but the people who were cluttering the place up were just impossible to believe, you know, so many of them, and in such poor conditions themselves. And of course, well, you get it all over India anyway, begging, but at that time it was absolutely thick with them, literally thick with them.
Were you given any advice on how to handle this?
Just ignore it. You couldn't ignore it if you tripped over somebody who was dead in the gutter or something. But generally ignore it, and that was it, and chase them off with a few choice Indian words which the military used occasionally.
This was your own strategy, or was this sort of advice from the military hierarchy?
Well, it was a combination. Mainly, it was your own choice to deal with it, because the military couldn't say. I mean, they had police there to come and chase some of them away occasionally, but the Sikh taxi drivers who drove like like idiots, I mean, around the place, probably they killed half the people who were dead in the gutters anyway. I don't know. But, yes, it was, as I say, the city buildings, streets, squares, green patches with trees and grass and all the rest of it. It was a very impressive city, and also where the Ganges comes down through the city was very impressive. But it was just all these appalling people who were around. They couldn't help it. It's just a way of life in India. And of course they'd come in from some of the places where the Japs weren't getting near, but they felt they were getting near, because they were hundreds of miles away from there at the time.
You were talking about entertainment. I mean, did you ever get any things like ENSA shows or concert parties?
No, they hadn't. Well, if they'd started, they hadn't got around to India around that time. No, I think it was a bit later on, when we'd moved a bit further, before we got things like ENSA parties. You get the occasional show put on in the unit by some of the people there who'd volunteered or were otherwise inveigled into acting something or other, or singing or joking or whatever it was. But at that time there weren't any official touring entertaining parties coming around.
Did you get, this was in the hospitals, or are you talking about when you rejoined your unit, the second?
Anywhere. In the hospitals or back at the unit. I don't think they came around to that. Or if they did, as I say, they hadn't got out as far as India. Because the only way they could travel those days anyway was on ship. And most ships were otherwise filled.
Going on to your this very uncomfortable sounding stay at the race course, were there many of you there?
Oh yes, there must have been hundreds, but I really couldn't say how many hundreds, because the stands were just about full of people, and they weren't there to watch the races. They were military who were there on the stands. And when you went down to the cookhouse to get a meal, the queues were, they felt never ending, really masses of them. And it was there where we learnt about how to deal with some hawks which used to hang around. That's I think the proper name was Kite Hawks, but it wasn't that that the army members called them. And the best way, because as you walked, you had to collect your food at the where they were dishing it out at the cookhouse, and then walk across a green patch until you could find a place to sit under a tree or something like that. And as you were walking across this open space, these so-and-so animals, birds, used to come down and phoom, your dinner was gone all over the place, and they'd pinch the best bits, the meat or whatever it was. So we found the ways to deal with them. Didn't stop them, of course, but you tie a long length of string to a piece of meat and then peg it down to the ground somewhere. And it came down and swooped on this piece of meat and tried to take it up. Toom, the string pulled them down onto the ground again. Or else you'd put down a heap of mashed potato and they couldn't get a very good grip with their talons on mashed potato. Childish things, but I mean, you did try to keep the damn things away. I can't say how many people were there. I suppose some, too, I think, were sleeping around the track. The place was absolutely bulging.
Sounds very uncomfortable. I mean, how did you fare?
Well, we were only there about 3-4 days, maybe. So, it was pretty uncomfortable, but we did keep hoping that before long we'd move on somewhere, back to our unit, hopefully. And, as I say, we did, by the means of hearing from somebody where they were going to be and when.
Yeah, that was by accident. I mean, was there any attempt officially to reunite people with their particular units that you were aware of?
Well, I suppose that the camp authorities, whoever they may be, at Calcutta, tried to find where people's units were and tried to reunite any members of those units from their camp with the units they wanted to go back to. But we certainly didn't have time to hear anything about it from people at the camp. RSM adjutant or whoever, and it was just a question of if you found out where they were, if you wanted to anyway, you'd go and slink back to them somehow or the other, and that we did. I mean, if they'd been staying in Ranchi for a few days more, we'd have got a train up there and rejoined them there. But otherwise, as they were moving out, we felt we'd go and move in the same direction and try to join up with them again on the way, or there, wherever they got to.
So from your own particular point of view, it certainly seems that there was no active attempt by the authorities to match you up with your unit.
No, well, I suppose they'd got so many people there, and they'd come from... There had been quite a few different units in Burma, and perhaps it was a bit much for them to try and find out who was where and how you could get there, sort of thing. I'll let them off with that.
Sounds reasonable. Sounds like quite a difficult job.
Yes.
So anyway, you rejoined and you went to Dahond with them, or rejoined them at...
Yes, went to Dahond, yes. And Dahond was only a bit of a village, or perhaps a small town, not far from Pune. Pune was the main place you could go to if you wanted any activity, of which there wasn't a great deal anyway, even at Pune. But You could go to a cinema or some show like that, probably in Pune. But Dond was, we very rarely got out of it.
What was it exactly? Was it an army camp, or was it an army camp on the edges of an Indian town called Dond?
Yes, it was an army camp on the edges of this town called Dond. And I don't think the buildings had been up very long. I think they must have been put up, not for us, but for somebody to occupy them, not very long before we got there. And we probably learnt that this camp was empty, and so we were moved into that spot. There was enough accommodation not only for us, but for the new people when they came out from England a little later on. And it was quite comfortable, well, as camps go, with the Indian style beds, that is a frame with four legs on it, and then ropes across it, and then you put your blankets and things on top of that. At least you were off the ground with its beetles and other things running around. Bugs too, I suppose, yes. Although it hadn't really got round to being crammed with too many objects by then. But they just appeared out of nothingness anyway.
What, the wildlife?
The wildlife, yes. And flies, of course, millions. But, and we had a decent cookhouse with our own cooks back again. The officers had the officers' mess, sergeants had the sergeants' mess, and all that kind of thing. It very commodious, you might say.
So your bedding was a rope sort of a sort of rope spring. Where the springs were, there were ropes. You had blankets on that. Did you have mattresses or palliasses or biscuits or whatever they called them?
Nothing of that at that time. No, you just had to make do with the blankets. Well, perhaps under that you'd put a ground sheet just to help make it a little more rigid. Otherwise, eventually you'd sort of sink into this when the strings stretched. But they were quite comfortable when you're in your early 20s or whatever, you don't notice such things.
You were talking about the wildlife. I mean, you sort of mentioned flies and beetles and bugs and things. I often wonder about snakes in India. Did you ever have any problem with them?
No. I never remember seeing one at all in that trip during our passage. I saw one in Burma, but I mean, which was a cobra. But I didn't see anything at all in India on that occasion. I had when I was out there as a youngster, but that was a very long time before. I was about 4 years old, I think. No, there weren't any. In fact, we saw more in the desert, in the western desert, I think, than anywhere else.
You talked earlier about the monsoon. Well, you're in Dond now, and it's the beginning of June.
Yes.
Did the monsoon ever catch up with you?
Well, not at Dond. It was after, when we went down to Bombay, that the monsoon really came. And it... It's impossible to explain a monsoon. It's mean, you think it rains hard here sometimes, but if you see a monsoon come down, it's really something. And the storm drains that they have there at the sides of the roads are things you could go and lose yourself in, more or less. But it didn't, no, it never bothered us up there. It would have been a bit awkward because it was all just bare ground with pebbles and things. The roads were being built by the natives while we were there. They were still building the roads. Women walking along with huge boulders on their heads for the men to chop and lay somewhere to make the roads. If we'd had the monsoon, then it really would have been pretty shocking. But as I say, we didn't get it until we got down to Bombay. You see, up at Pune, you're on the Western Ghats, I think it's called. You're 2,000 or 3,000 feet above sea level. So when the rains come, it rains straight down these hills and gathers around Bombay and all down there. But even without it gathering, it when it comes down, it's really appalling. Fortunately, it's warm in between showers, so if you've got wet, you just dry off by walking about in the sunshine. Simple as that. But when it does come down, oh dear, solid sheets of rain is not in it.
So the monsoon isn't a sort of long continuous downpour. It's lots of very heavy
showers, really. But there are some places where I believe it can, such as in Assam. I forget how many inches they get there, about 300 inches a year or something. When it comes down, it comes down for a long time, continually. But when it came down on us in Bombay and around there, it was more or less, yes, very heavy showers. And you could, everybody carried umbrellas, you needed to. We didn't, unfortunately, but all the locals did anyway. And they certainly needed them, because, well, sometimes it came down so hard the umbrellas just vanished in the downpour, a sort of collapse. terrible. And you'd be sort of paddling along in a few inches of water on the road because the drains, which were enormous, just couldn't take it.
What about the heat? I mean,
the heat is appalling during the monsoon. It's appalling before the monsoon, in the week or two or a month before the monsoon. Humidity is appalling. Very little air to move it to, so you just sort of stood and dripped, sweated, pouring out of you. You couldn't help it. And then when the monsoon comes, it's so darn wet you can't tell anyway whether it's you or the weather that's done it. But the humidity was still extremely high, naturally, because the air was full of it. It was only just after the monsoon ended that you really felt cool again. Well, cool for there, not cool for here. It'd still be hot here.
It's all relative.
Yes, but it was cool, airy.
What about getting back into the swing of the regiment? I mean, you've been away from them for what, March until June. So, What happened to you when you got back?
Well, just everything took over again as it had done, more or less. You You met the people you knew, you chatted with them, you did whatever work had to be done according to work allocation. Life just went on as it had done in, let's say, other, should we say, quieter times, when you were, when you got the new vehicles and new tanks and all this kind of thing, and you did a bit of training on this, and you went around in the vehicles, you'd go out to buy some produce somewhere, or go out to take a truck full of people to go and police the rioters and crowds. It was just back to normal until we got the Duke of Gloucester out to come and examine us. I think we only had about 100 people on parade then. And, no, I better not comment on that.
Please do.
Well, he had a rather a name for liking his liquor. And I'm sure that apart from being sort of propped up in his jeep as he went around, he couldn't have seen us anyway. But he, I don't know, he came out and a few underlings with him, and apparently enjoyed the day in the officers' mess, and saw us, and we all cheered him and that kind of thing, and then back to normal again.
Was a lot of spit and polish required?
Oh, vast no amount, yes. And
before he arrived?
Yes. And it was a bit awkward with having this sort of bare earth around the place that, to try and keep things spit and polished in good proper nick, you know.
I was interested in what your routine was, because, of course, at this time you had no vehicles.
No.
Certainly no fighting vehicles to speak of. So, I mean, what was your routine?
Well, at that time, it was mainly keeping clear and clean the camp, the huts, doing the usual whitewash here and there, and the sort of stupid things that they gave you to do sometimes just to occupy your mind and body. We still had small arms, so we had to do a bit of training with those, loading pistols, firing them, and even a few rifles around the place to keep some people occupied, and keeping all that lot clean and polished and everything else. And then when it wasn't very long before we started getting trucks, vehicles of some kind or the other, and the odd jeep or two, and then they, of course, had to be maintained and tested and cleaned and all the rest of it, whilst also in between times when we had these trucks and things, we went out on these policing jobs. So I wouldn't say you were fully occupied, but quite sufficiently occupied in your time. They could always find something for you to do anyway, one way or the other.
Did you ever go on these police duties? Did you ever do any of that?
Yes, I did a couple of those, I think it was. You just went out and you didn't actually wave a magic wand, but very often the sight of a truckload of army personnel coming out with their pistols on and so on, even if you had no arms for them, no ammunition for them, seemed to clear the troublemakers more easily than they would have done at just the sight of one or two of their local police.